Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Osher Ginsburg podcast. I'm Osher Ginsburg. This is episode 136 of the show with Alice Fraser. She's a writer. She's a comedian. She's very, very clever. You can follow her on Twitter at alliterative, A-L-I-T-E-R-A-T-I-V-E, alliterative on Twitter. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all the support that I've been getting on Patreon. You can support the show by pledging a monthly amount, patreon.com/osher. If you support for as little as $5 a month, you can get access to exclusive episodes. There's a new one of them coming soon. But if you want to donate one off, that's fine. If you don't want to donate at all, that is also fine. I'm just grateful that you are here. Quick intro this week. As you know, I've been transitioning from one set of meds to the other this week. Oh, this is your new show. Hi, I'm Osher. I'm the guy from the telly with the roses and the things, and I live with a mental illness, and I talk about it on the show. So, hi, this is your new show, first episode. G'day. Here we are talking about brains. Anyway, I've been transitioning from one set of meds to another, trying to do the balancing act of benefits to side effects, I'll call it that. And yeah, so we're currently in the phase of cutting down one set of meds and then lay fallow for a few days and then ramp up on the other one. So I'll keep you posted for now, though. I'm just keeping busy, trying to get on the bike as much as I can, trying to eat well, feeling my feet. Been feeling my feet a lot lately. And just, you know, little things like getting present to the smell of Audrey's cologne. I know that sounds weird, but, you know, it helps me get back in the room. Thanks for all the messages that everyone sent me through this week. I do read every email you send me. I'll write back to most of them. Send osheremail@gmail.com. Since we've talked last, James Matheson has announced that he's going to run up against Tony Abbott in Warringah. If you're from out of the country, James, who I used to do Australian Idol with and Channel V with, is running up against our ex-Prime Minister in his home electorate, which is where James lives. And I love him. I've always loved him, and people are just starting to see the kind of man that I always knew. The smart, clever, compassionate, kind love and acceptance. James, he did a fantastic job the other day on the Bolt Report, if you saw that. Just brilliant. Love and acceptance, man. Love and acceptance. It's going to be good. His episode's episode 100, if you want to get a clue as to what kind of guy he is. If you just think he's the bloke from the telly, you think again. So let me tell you about my guest today, Alice Fraser. She is a comedian, a writer, and an ex-lawyer from Australia. She's also host of the wonderfully cerebral podcast Tea with Alice, which I'm very happy to say I have been a guest on. We actually recorded the episode that I was on of her show and this show on the same day. We basically just swapped memory cards out of my Zoom and away we went. We did hers first. So if there's parts of this conversation that don't make sense, just pop back to that episode and you should have a better idea and flesh a few things out. You should listen to her show anyway because it's pretty great. Alice has a very interesting story. She's a fascinating woman. She's very, very clever. And her story, which I love, her story is about following what you believe in finding your truth, and what monetary rewards balance up against that truth, or even the joy of that journey. And the way she describes that is a really, really beautiful thing. If you like what you hear, let her know. She's on Twitter, Alliterative, A-L-I-T-E-R-A-T-I-V-E. That's where you can find her. Listen to her show. The Alice Fraser podcast is called Tea with Alice. But enjoy this. Cups of tea at my coffee table. Well, dining table, actually. Around the big furniture. The big kids' table with Alice Fraser.
Hey, Alice.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right.
Fancy meeting you here.
So in the preamble, I would have told people what we just did.
Yes.
And I will point them in the direction of your show, which I'm grateful for because it is such a very different conversation than the one we're about to have.
Because it's about...
Which is really nice. Not only because it's about you, but just also the way conversation takes place. So hopefully it'll be a fantastic anthropological study for folks who listen to go, oh, this is what these two people sound like when they have this particular outcome in mind and then that particular outcome in mind.
Depending on who has the reins of the conversation.
Or, yeah, who, or not necessarily. Yeah, maybe the reins or what's the goal, you know? You sat down and said, like, oh, you know, what's a difficult idea at the start of your show and the way we went.
That's true.
But this is kind of different. Yeah, so we're in Sydney and you're here as part of the Sydney Comedy Festival.
Yes. Sydney is originally my home. I've only lived in Melbourne for about 8 months, so...
Ah, okay.
I feel like this is coming home, except that I'm only here for 4 days.
Where did you grow up?
Sydney. So I grew up in Rose Bay, Double Bay.
Oh, right, so nearby.
Yeah, it's funny when you go to Melbourne and people try to compare the two cities. They say, oh, Melbourne's much easier and much better, and I initially had this super defensive reaction of like, no, Sydney's amazing, and I realise what I think of when I think of Sydney is the eastern suburbs of Sydney, which is amazing.
Mm.
And then Greater Sydney, you know, public transport gets difficult and it becomes more complicated. And
yeah, it's amazing because there's a harbour in the middle of it, but it's shitty to get around because there's a harbour in the middle of it.
Yeah. Yeah, but then the harbour and the water means that you, in the middle of a city, have access to the wilderness.
Yeah.
The untamed wilderness.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
It's like
there's
right
nowhere
there.
Like that.
Yeah, it's pretty glorious. But yeah, then you get... What always fascinates me, and I remember this the first time I went to Europe, is that once you get, I don't know, 5 km out of any city centre, it's just homogenous Western society suburbs. Mm. And you could be anywhere in the world. You
go to a shopping mall. Never appealed to me as an end goal.
Where was I? I was in the outskirts of Lyon in France. And I was like, a shopping mall. I could be anywhere. It smelled like cinnamon donuts and deep fried things.
Capitalism.
Everywhere. It's the same. So, you know, shopping mall, church, high school, suburbs, shopping mall, church, high school, suburbs. Just kept going. Medical centre. Kept going. And countryside eventually. And it's the same, I guess, in a westernised society, that's kind of the model.
Well, if it's driven by sort of needs and desires.
Yeah.
Car repair place.
Yeah, that we copy and paste that. For all around the world, but then you get to parts of a city like Melbourne, for example. The parts of Melbourne that make Melbourne are glorious because you can't get them anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Same parts of Sydney that make Sydney, incredible,
impossible to replicate.
Parts of Brisbane that make Brisbane, like you can have an amazing house on the water, live in this beautiful kind of Federation era home, or even Victorian era home, right on the river, and you can be 15 minutes from the city and the jungle everywhere. It's great. I love it. Did you go to school out here as well?
I did, yeah. I went to a languages school, international grammar, which was at Redfern in the old Revlon factory. So I knew without knowing it a lot of junkies when I was growing up. And then,
who was the first junkie you met?
Well, there was a guy in the bushes in the Out of Bounds area, and if you dared somebody to go into the Out of Bounds area, you'd see this guy and he'd flash you, and then you'd run back to the rest of the kids.
How old were you?
This is primary school, so young.
And the teachers were cool with this?
Well, no, not when they found out. He got arrested by... We had two constables who used to just hang out, and they were our teachers' quote-unquote boyfriends, and they would just occasionally... you know, tackle somebody in our playground and...
Oh, so people realised there were, you know, dodgy...
There was a couple of dodgy,
sex pests hiding in the bushes.
Yeah.
Let's just get Constable Barry come and...
I think one... Yeah, that was that. And I didn't realise... Again, you don't realise that your childhood is weird until you grow up and realise that other people didn't
When you're that little, do you know that a grown man exposing himself to a little girl is this form of sexual violence?
No.
You didn't feel weird in the tummy or anything?
No.
Wow.
I never did it. I would always win.
Truth or dare?
Usually other games, sort of sporty games, but...
All right. And if you lose...
Then you have to go into the
and look at the junkie's penis. No, I don't want to play games with you in the schoolyard. Phrase it? No.
I think those things don't strike you as weird or unusual. They weren't sexualized because there was no relationship existing with that man.
Is it
a penis is not inherently offensive or sexual.
But there's something got to be weird and aggressive about a grown man.
I don't know. I think he was probably a deeply troubled human being. Yeah. I don't even know if he was present in the situation. If he's not present in the situation, is it a sexual exploitation? Like, where was his brain?
He was having a...
I have no idea what his brain was doing.
Yeah.
And certainly for the kids who were involved, it was a game. It wasn't a situation that anybody was being coerced into or
Did
being
he
sexualized.
Live there? Was like he there for
I
days
have
at
no
a time?
Idea. I just remember it very clearly, sort of people running into the bushes and running out screaming and giggling.
Fuck me.
But that was, yeah.
And it was the International Language School, is that what you said?
IGS, International Grammar School.
So what happens there?
Music and languages. So you learn music and musical instrument is important to learn, and then two languages.
And what was
your...
And you
do them for an hour or so a day. German and Italian.
And the flute?
Oh, the violin and the piano.
Oh, because one's not enough.
No.
Violin and
one's
piano.
Never enough.
Yeah, no one's ever really going to go out. It's not just going to say... You know, oboe.
The two least cool instruments, yeah. I think.
I'm going to go double reed. First go, I'm going to go double reed.
Double. My brother played the cello, which I was sort of jealous about.
No one says dulcimer, do they?
Hammer dulcimer? My mum used to play the hammer dulcimer.
Well, as your instrument, you know.
Oh, no, yeah, she played lots of instruments.
Yeah, well, that's super
all
cool.
of the instruments.
So your house was full of music?
Full of music and instruments until we were about 7 or 8 when she stopped being able to play them. But then the instruments were still there.
What was the more interesting instruments that you had?
So,
hammer dulcimer is pretty cool. Not many people have a hammer dulcimer. If you don't know what it is, it's basically it's a stringed instrument, and the musical notes are played by striking a string under tension, and the way they're arranged is very beautiful. And sometimes you see people with multiple hammers so they can get harmonies.
So you imagine if you open up a grand piano and look at the strings. It's sort of like a small version of that.
Well, a piano makes a sound by a hammer hitting a string anyway, but this is basically taking the mechanics out of it.
Yeah, and doing it by hand.
And it's a beautiful sounding.
It's a really lovely instrument.
Well, we had a spinet in our house, which is a single manual harpsichord.
That is a very Pride and Prejudice sort of drawing room.
Baroquean, yeah, very. Dad was right into it, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Mum had a accordion squeeze box, penny whistles, many penny whistles. She played the banjo and all sorts of just any kind of instrument she could play it and would play it.
So lullabies, banjo accompaniment?
No, just singing. Lullabies always have to be, I think, just voice.
I think my dad would...
Lullabies are an a cappella.
Yeah, well, Dad would sing to us, but it was all in Czech.
All
the lullabies he knew were in Czech, so he had a chromatic harmonica that he taught himself to play, and he taught himself to play spinet as well. But he had a chromatic harmonica that he would basically play the melodies of the Czech folk songs to help us go to sleep.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
Mum and Dad would sing harmonies sometimes.
Of course they did.
Of course they did. But Czechoslovakian. My dad's side of the family is Hungarian Czech.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, the Russians had a bit of a hand in both those places.
Yeah.
So your folks, did they meet in Australia? Where did they meet?
They did. They met at university. So
that's nice.
That is nice. It's a nice thing. And apparently they were at a party and they'd met each other and had cups of tea before and liked each other. And then Dad said, "Oh, can I get your number?" And Mum, he held out his wrist and Mum had a pen and she wrote it on the inside cuff of his coat.
Nice.
And he thought, "Oh, she wants me
that's
to
a
remember
permanent
mark. That." Yeah, that's a statement of intent.
Yeah.
Mum argued afterwards that it wasn't. She just thought that was what he was suggesting.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Your dad and Mum grew up in Australia?
Yes. So Dad's a first-generation Australian. His parents were both immigrants. They met here at Red Leaf Pool. So my grandmother was a Hungarian Holocaust survivor and came out and worked in a shoe factory. And my grandfather was a Czechoslovakian Holocaust survivor, and he was a human rights lawyer and then later became a sort of a businessman, and they met at Red Leaf Pool.
Wow.
And got together.
It's a heck of a thing to be the son or daughter of a Holocaust survivor. My ex-wife's Israeli, and it's a country full of
traumatized people
and their children.
Epigenetic
Survivor syndrome, it's called, yeah.
Yeah, there's
people
a lot
hiding
of damage.
Food under the bed and stuff like that.
There's all sorts of different... I mean, statistically, I'm more likely to have things like anxiety and eating disorders because of that. and that stuff is in the blood in a very strong and strange way. I don't know how much it would have affected my dad had he not become Buddhist later on, but...
Did your father ever speak about his parents talking to him about what happened?
Granny didn't talk about it a lot. My father's father died when he was 7.
Was he driven to find out about it?
Yeah, I think they all are. I mean, my grandmother had one of those sort of... Anyone who got out has these amazing stories, and she'd tell them sometimes, but it was mainly friends of hers who would tell Dad or tell us. They'd, you know, corner us sometime in the... after a dinner or something and say, "You know, your grandmother's a hero. She did this," or...
What did she do?
All sorts of things. She disguised herself as a postwoman, Christian postwoman, for a period of time, and she would go and sell bread into the ghettos for money, pretending that money was worth... She pretended to be an idiot and she pretended that she thought money was worth anything compared with bread. And she was being at one point taken to the camps but put bread under her eyelids to mimic the symptoms of conjunctivitis, because the Nazis were weird in that way. They wouldn't kill you if you were sick, wouldn't send you on a death march unless you were fit to go. And she rescued... There's sort of a lot of stories where she rescued her friends, and there's bits of those stories that are elided, and I never know how true they are or how much, you know, how much to read into the sentence. For example, "We acquired a Nazi uniform." You know, like...
Yeah.
You don't know what the story in that story is. I'm always interested in how you can tell stories, the same story, in so many different ways, depending on what you focus
on.
Have
you been over to Europe and had a look at some of that stuff?
I have never been to Hungary, but I've been around Europe. I've been to Germany and I've seen some of the, you know, the things there, which are quite confronting. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been to a camp.
Pretty horrifying.
Yeah. When you look at the... And, you know, people make a lot of noise about what's happening in Iraq at the moment, the brutality of what's happening. It doesn't hold a candle to the mechanized...
Systematized.
Systematic, extraordinarily efficient slaughter by educated Christian people of... educated Jewish people in a modern capitalist society.
Yeah.
Less than 75 years ago. Bananas.
And then you think, how could people have ignored that or turned a blind eye to it? Or And then you see on a small scale what's happening with our refugees.
Mm.
And people know that those conditions are horrific.
Mm.
I mean, not to the same degree. We're not burning people in ovens, but inhumane conditions. And people sort of fret about it a little bit, but mainly don't think about it at all.
Mm.
That's terrifying. Yeah. And you just see it in people.
So how did your father find Buddhism?
He was a... So he went through university, was a philosophy lecturer,
uh-huh.
truth seeker, looking for the truth, and found nothing in philosophy that sort of held more than, you know, going back to basic principles, everything sort of requires a certain element of faith or belief, and then encountered Buddhism, and for him it was the first thing that didn't require faith or abdication of intellectual capacity. It was something that, you know, you had to experience, but it wasn't asking you to pretend you were experiencing it or to suspend disbelief in any way. And he found it really good and useful and sort of locked into that and became, as many converts to anything do, just the most Buddhist. And he was going out with Mum, and she started meditating as well, and then she was diagnosed with MS. And then...
Before they were married?
Before they were married. Then they got pregnant with us, and then they were married. So, yeah, they decided to get married and have children after she was diagnosed, which I think is a pretty brave move.
Beautiful thing.
They didn't know what would happen. I mean, MS at that point was a completely unknown quantity.
Mid-70s?
It was the early 80s, early 80s. So they didn't know what was going to happen or how long it was going to take or which bits it would take. MS takes chunks. Don't know what goes next. Yeah. Some people lose.
Friend of mine died.
Yeah, it's nasty. But among other things, getting pregnant slows down the disease.
Hmm.
So I was a prescription baby. My twin brother and I they decided to have us and see what happened, if nothing else, because it was going to get harder.
Yeah.
To have children, look after children.
Yeah.
And she was pretty good until, I mean, she had a lot of sleep. She napped a lot and she didn't like loud noises. But other than that, just normal, good, excellent mum until we were about 10. Which and I think is enough, you know.
On one hand, you've got a dad who's... Like, did your dad ever talk about the Holocaust?
No, not really. I mean, he didn't like to talk about it other than to sort of say you should learn about it.
Yeah.
But don't go too deep.
Right.
Because there are people who... I mean, Australian comedian Sandy Gutman...
Yeah, he's been on the show. Case,
he can't get his head out of it.
No.
His whole life has been sublimated in... just the horror, and it is horrible. If you think about it too much, you can't not think about it. Yeah. And there's bits of it that control my life even now where it's a dumb thing, thought experiment that I run whenever I meet a new person or I make a new friend. Just think, well, would you have been a Nazi?
And if you don't have to look too far. I mean, good on them being so stringent in their documentation of what was going on. Just shamelessly, it's like, yeah, well, in fact, we'll film everything. Yeah, and we'll take really, really good photos of everyone and everything.
Good notes.
Yeah, really good notes.
I mean, it's the serial killer you want to find if you're police constable.
Goodness gracious me. Yeah, and, you know, when you think about, you know, the initial allies' reactions, there's a story of, I don't know if it was Auschwitz. It's probably not. It's probably
Birkenau.
The Allies roll in and they saw what was happening. You know, they saw this just like walking dead, literally, people. And there's a story of they lined all the officers up against the wall and nobody gave the command. But the Americans just executed a lot of them. They were just so...
Horrified.
And I mean, I want to weep, you know, they just... There was no trial. I mean, essentially, it's a war crime. But these guys were just like, we cannot believe you have done this. In fact, this, and just that, just like that, the justice. Like what they thought was justice. But yeah.
It's arguable. Justice is a slippery concept.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry to harp on about it, but you know, no. I just don't really meet many people who've had, you know, that family. I mean,
it
like
shapes
I told you,
your idea of the
in
world.
In America, it's different. There's obviously because of the diaspora, you meet a lot more people who are survivors and sons and daughters of survivors, and certainly in Israel, like I said. Heaps. I mean, my ex-mother-in-law, she was born in Auschwitz.
Wow.
Yeah, she was born there. Yeah, she was a baby when they were liberated, but she was born there.
Wow, that's horrifying.
Yeah. It's full on, right? And then when I meet people who don't know what it is, or when I meet people who, oh yeah, but that was a long time ago. Like, it wasn't uneducated people. It was the best ideas of the smartest minds of the most brilliant people at the time that came up with this.
Yeah, and you think about the time at which it happened as well, coming out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, coming out of the revolution of kind of libertarianism that was happening in Berlin at the time in the cabaret clubs. How could that be happening at the same time as this resentment and rage was building in people against...
Well, everything.
Everything.
But let's scapegoat this lot.
Yeah, let's pin it on the Jews.
Yeah. Full on. Sorry, that got heavy. So you were brought up Buddhist?
I was brought up Buddhist. So that's my upbringing, I guess. It's my frame for the world.
Do you have a shrine in the house, that kind of thing?
In my parents' house, yeah. In my dad's house, there is a meditation room.
So cool.
Yeah. It's good, I think. Again, it's very hard to reflect on those things. The only way that I kind of can contextualize it for somebody who doesn't have the same experience as me is the first time I went to an art gallery and was old enough to register it properly and realized all of the kind of Christian religious iconography was of a piece and realized how brutal it all is.
Yeah. I haven't been in a Catholic church. I went to their schools and I went there. But the last time I went to one, I can't remember what I was there for. It wasn't a wedding. Or was it? I can't remember. Anyway, I was in there. It was a christening. And there's this 12-foot high statue of a horrific, torturous murder happening.
And then all the saints and the martyrs around the site holding their, you know, dismembered boobs on plates or eyes or, you know, arrows through them, like suffering. And this fetishization of suffering as a means of worship was completely alien to me.
Yeah, it would have been weird.
The idea that there's a virtue to sacrifice in that way. In Buddhism, sort of death or sacrifice is always a pragmatic thing. It's not a noble thing. Maybe it's noble, but it's not this sort of wallowing in pain thing.
Yeah,
that struck me as so. And I don't think that permeates modern Christianity or the idea of modern Christianity as much as it seems to in the religious iconography. But it struck me so hard as like, whoa, this is really intense.
Did you have a hard time explaining to your friends at school?
Well, IGS, which was this,
it
was lots of kids from different cultures, lots of different languages, lots of different people. So that was okay. Everyone was different. There was seven different languages there and you could...
Okay.
We had a lot of multiculturalism, which is weird, less popular now, multiculturalism as a philosophy. This idea that you go and you eat the food and you wear the clothes and you experience the thing, that's seen as appropriative or... upsetting in some way, which is weird to me because the clothes of Burmese Buddhism is the strain of Buddhism that I was brought up in. Those are my clothes that I grew up with. So it feels weird to me when I see somebody who doesn't look like they should be wearing the clothes that they're wearing and immediately get piled on as a trivializing or appropriating or... ruining somebody else's
like an
integrity.
Indian chief eagle headdress at Coachella.
I mean, I think that's slightly different because there's religious significance in that.
Yeah, there is.
And I would probably find it, I'd understand more if somebody's super offended by that in the same way as I'd understand if somebody was incredibly offended by somebody dressing up as a nun for pornography or... I found it confronting. Someone had a comedy show about being a Buddhist monk. And he was walking around in the robes of a Buddhist monk. I found that very upsetting because the symbolism of that is...
But he wasn't a monk.
He wasn't a monk. Huh. I found it upsetting on a sort of a visceral thing because it's a very serious thing to be.
Mm.
So I was like, oh, a bit... Mm.
What's the difference between Buddhisms, like Burmese Buddhism v. Tibetan Buddhism?
A huge difference. As many differences as there are between Christianity and Judaism, despite ostensibly having the same God.
Shh. Don't tell anyone Jesus was Jewish.
He was a rabbi.
I don't like it.
He was a rabbi.
I've been to the temple. I've stood on the steps. He would have walked up to say, hey, stop with the selling stuff on church day.
Yeah.
I stood there.
That's nice.
Yes. Yeah, he was. He was Jew, but I don't really like that. I don't really like to know that.
It's a weird history revisionism stuff.
It's wild, right?
Super weird. Yeah, there's heaps of different strains of Buddhism.
Yeah, so what's the main differences?
The main division, I think, between Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism is the main sort of division. And Mahayana is sort of broad path. That includes all sort of Buddhist-ish things, all the way out to sort of yogic practices and things that are interpretive, things that are sort of evolving and adaptive. Theravada Buddhism is well, I guess you'd call it closer to stricter or fundamentalism, in that it doesn't depart from the original teachings and it always calls back to the original teachings. It's less. Less secondary discourses, less sort of, so, you know, Zen Buddhism is based on one particular discourse of the Buddha, whereas Theravada Buddhism is all, you know, taking it all as all of the teachings, but only the teachings, rather than any sort of departures. So I don't know, you can imagine I was as brought up in as close to fundamentalism as you get with Buddhism.
Right,
which is... as I said, not a faith-based religion. So it's difficult to get real fundamentalist.
Yeah, but it can be just, I guess you'd call it strict practice.
Strict practice, I think.
So no meat eating and that kind of thing.
No meat getting.
No meat getting.
Right. The meat itself is not the problem.
It's the killing of the meat.
Killing. So the four elements of taking life... that you have to know it's a being is sentient, that you have to want to kill it, that you have to take action to kill it, and that it has to die. Those are the four component parts of the wrong act of taking life. So I will eat meat if I think it's going to be thrown away, genuinely. Not like, whoa, are you going to... Genuinely. Not like my brother's friend who used to come over and be like, can I have a chicken, lettuce and tomato sandwich because he was kosher and not allowed to eat bacon. Genuinely, if I think it's going to go to waste, I have no problem with the substance. It's just matter. It's just atoms in a particular arrangement. But I don't particularly want to have to think about where I am in the causal chain of an animal's death in the light of a commercialized factory farming. Like, fuck, I just don't want to have to figure out that.
Yeah.
I tend not to eat meat.
Right.
That's a general rule. Because of that.
When was the first time as a kid you realized that, oh, wow, this is what I thought was the world? It was as we kids, it's fine. Our parents are our gods and, you know, the world they create for us is the world we live in. And everyone else is a bit different for a while, but then you realize maybe I'm the one that's not.
I'm the weird freak.
Yeah.
I got bullied a lot.
Ugh.
But
At high school by this point?
Yeah, both. Yeah. Both primary school. Primary school was easier because I had my twin brother and we got bullied together, and that doesn't matter so much.
Send them off to the flasher in the bushes if they don't upset with
you. We looked after each other there. High school, I went to an all-girls school. It was a jungle of, you know, social experimentation on one another, in which I didn't navigate particularly well.
Mm.
I was a weird kid. I really was. I'm a weird adult, but it's fine now. Now I get points for being the weird that I am, but I didn't then.
At what point did you... And so what did you do instead? Like,
I went to the library and read.
About?
Horrible fantasy novels mainly, but anything, everything. I mean, from about year 8, which was the time at which I was sort of... cut out of the herd, I was too proud to try and elbow my way back in from the bottom. So I just would go to the library in.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
During class, outside of class, during lunchtime, just read books in the corner. Escape, escape, escape.
Did they let you eat in the library?
No, they didn't let me eat in the library. I would usually eat on the way to or from school. Yeah. Eating was a weird thing at that time for us because Mum couldn't really cook, or she was getting to the point where she couldn't. She'd sort of burn things more often than not, and so we were sort of learning to cook for ourselves or for the family. At about 11, 12, that was when we were trying to figure it out. And yeah, there's sort of vaguely complicated stuff about food, I think. Culturally different between Mum and Dad. The Anglo, just have a sandwich, dear, and the Jewish Hungarian, eat. And so food as love or not was a sort of a fraught issue.
What would you want people listening to know? What would you want them to know about what it is to be a kid with a parent that's got a terminal illness?
What would I want who to know, I guess?
People who are listening.
Who don't know
what it's like.
I'd want them to see my last show, Savage. Because that's what that was. Yeah. That was that, I mean, there's a couple of things, but just that you think that the person who you are with is all of their component parts, but it's amazing how much you can take away from a person and still love them as that person and still have them be that person to you, when all of the sort of identifying features that were so important to them in their identity or so important to you in their identity are gone. So I think a good example of that is initiation function. So that's the ability to do what you want to do. So pick up this coffee cup. So in my teen years, we noticed, like, Mum would say she'd go to get milk and she wouldn't get milk. Or she'd say she was going to do something and she wouldn't. And that is annoying. And you think of that as a personality trait, your ability as a person to get things done. I'm the kind of person who gets things done, or is the kind of person who doesn't get things done. It wasn't until a little bit later when she had another brain scan and we realised that that was a part of the brain that was damaged. So she couldn't do things, and it got worse over time to the point where it was not getting milk, it was picking up the coffee cup that was directly in front of her, and you could see that she wanted to get it, but she couldn't get it. And I think I had it quite easy because Mum was very calm about it all. She was sort of frustrated and upset by it at various points, but she'd sort of, the worst thing she ever really said was like, oh dear. And that was when, you know, she had a tumour that was exploding out of her stomach. Like,
oh,
it was
fuck me.
Just, she was very, very stoic and very, just dealt with it very practically.
Yeah.
So I think it was easier for us, and also that we were all a family and we looked after each other. Easier than it could have been.
Yeah.
But horrible.
So what you're saying, just so I hear you right, that the kid who's in that situation is trying to deal with
is loving someone not in the way that you loved your mum or you loved your dad. They're loving them for the piece of that person, that human, that makes them who they are. Doesn't really matter if they can't do this or that or this or that or this or that.
Yeah, but that you are, I guess, just coming to terms with death and loss in chunks.
Yeah.
Rather than all at once, very suddenly. Yeah. I think my whole teenage years were a process of grieving.
Yeah, the preemptive grief.
Bits of my mum that had been, you know, that she couldn't play her instruments anymore, that she kept wanting to write things but wasn't able to complete them, that...
Yeah.
You know, she wanted to go out, but she couldn't go out, or she wanted to, you know, things like not being the kind of person that can go out in public and be sure that you won't wet yourself, or,
yeah,
you know, those things that you think of as integral to your humanity are not at all important. They're not the bits that make you a person. They are things that are sad to lose, though. I don't know. I don't know if it's better or worse to be able to lose someone over 30 years or over one night.
I'm gonna say I'll take the slow burn. I'll take the slow burn before it allows me to. I'll take the pain that goes with it at the benefit of having the time to. Process, make adjustments.
When my mum died, I could honestly say I never said anything cruel or mean to her. I never... The only thing I ever regretted was running away to New York for a year, just, and that was just running away. After she had her first psychotic episode, I was like, I've got to go, because they said it would happen again, but they didn't know when. I thought, now, you know, I have to go now.
How old were you?
I was 25.
Right. And what were you in the middle of at the time?
I just finished my degree. I just finished my master's degree at Cambridge.
Cambridge
University.
In the UK?
In the UK, yeah.
Oh, wow. How does a kid from Rose Bay get to Cambridge?
By being incredibly smart.
Yeah, right answer!
No, I was just a big English nerd.
Yeah.
And I applied.
You were playing, you know, go and look at the flushing man in the pants in the yard, and I was reading books, and look what happened to me.
I was just a big reader of books, and I've always been good on words.
At what point did you realise that was within your grasp to go to a university like that?
I didn't really. Someone said the application process was due that day, and I was at the university, and I walked into my supervisor's office, my honours supervisor, and I said, can you write me a letter of recommendation? And then I went to athletics training, and I said to my coach, can you write me a letter of recommendation? And he said, sure. And then I put them in the envelope on my way home after athletics training and stuck them in the post box, and then went back to finish my law degree, which I really didn't want to do. Then I got the letter in the mail at home, and I read it, and they said, oh, you know, you've been accepted pending funding. And then the next letter in the pile was, you've been given this Commonwealth scholarship. And I walked out the door, and I went on the bus. I caught the bus to university from that point, Double Bay to Sydney University, and I walked up to the law faculty, and I said, hey, can I suspend my candidature for the next year or so? And they said, oh, why? You need to have a good reason. I said, I just got into Cambridge, and I showed them the letter, and they said, okay.
That's a good reason.
And then, because that was the third condition, you had to not be going to any other university.
Oh.
And then I called my brother on my little Nokia phone, and I said, I just got into Cambridge. And then I realised I wasn't wearing shoes. So, yeah, it was a good moment. It was good.
That's
it was
great.
A good moment in my life.
A buddy of mine studied, he was a research fellow at Cambridge, and I went up there to visit him. It's freaking amazing.
It is like living in a book.
Stood there and he goes, see that window there? I said, yeah. He says, that's Isaac Newton's office.
Yeah.
That's where he worked on his theories of gravity.
Yeah. He was a maniac. He put spoons in his eye to try and distort the lens so he could figure out how light worked.
Yeah, well, he was a Tim Ferriss of his day.
Complete madness.
What was it like? I mean, did you see Stephen Hawking rolling around and that kind of thing?
Did you hear that Stephen Hawking got pennying banned at the college that he's an honorary fellow at? Pennying is the process of throwing a penny into somebody's drink and they have to drink the drink before the queen drowns. But someone pennied his drink at a formal function and he took it as an insult and kicked up a fuss, tried to get the kid kicked out of university. Didn't work. But then he also had pennying banned at that college for 100 years. Which right. is pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah. One of the colleges doesn't have a boat shed named after them because they had their boat shed shut down for 100 years because somebody attached a sword to the front of the boat during bumps and someone got stabbed. So because the river is really narrow in Cambridge, it's not a wide river. In order to do races, you can't have side-by-side races. So what you have is these races where you're lined up and the idea is to bump / overtake the boat in front of you, which is you bring your
bow in front of their stern.
So someone attached a sword to the bow and
stabbed a coxswain,
and then that whole college.
100 years.
100 years is very epic.
Pete took me to a pub that had, you probably know the name of it. He took me to a pub that had all the World War II bomber pilots use cigarette lighters and put their names in the ceiling, burnt with cigarette lighters.
Yeah,
that was wild because there was an airfield nearby where they, you know, pop it with a ditch, drop a few bombs on Jerry, and be home for D and medals by 6.
Exactly, that kind of business. It's so laden with history, almost overwhelmingly. Yeah. Like everything you look at, you're like, that's a nice pond. Byron used to swim there.
And that square where they would meet for duels.
Yeah, yeah. There's still a bridge. The only place in England that's still legal to have a duel is on the bridge between King's College. And King's College lawns, meadows.
What was that time like? Like, were you meeting people? Like that. Was romance a part of your life at that point?
Sort of. In a very tame way, because it was the first time that I had had no responsibilities. It's the first time I didn't have to look after anybody but myself. So going wild for me was like, I can stay out as late as I want. I can bring people over with no qualm at any time of day or night. I can have tea with people. I can, you know, it's this very nerdy thing. And I think I went through the whole of the teenage process of relationships in a year, which I wasn't even up to kind of genuine relationships or having sex with anyone. I just did that thing where you just get punched in the face by incredibly painful crushes. You're just like, oh my god, he's amazing, and like you can just I just did the whole of teenage development in a year and a half, which hurt, you know, emotionally, because everyone else was an adult at that time and I wasn't in that part of my
Did you find anyone myself. Try to take advantage of you in that situation, in naivety?
There was one German guy who did this thing where I think it must have been an early version of negging, where he would give me these weird sort of compliment insults. And I think, again, I was probably even too naive to fall for it. I just was like, he's weird. That's rude. But I think I was sort of protected by my naivety.
Yeah.
It was an exciting and overwhelming period.
What was it like coming back to Sydney after that?
Hard. Partly because my friends in the comedy scene here, I wasn't in comedy explicitly. I was in the reviews and improv stuff. I wasn't doing stand-up yet. But the people who I'd thought were very close to me didn't welcome me back with open arms, which was a weird feeling. I felt like gaps had closed or something like that. And that was a strange thing. And it was hard to sort of slot back into family life and to those responsibilities and to the combination of responsibility and what happens when you get a lot of responsibility very early, or is when you're a child and you have these adult responsibilities, is you never transition, right? You don't go through the teenage rebellion where you fight with your parents that they see you as a real human being. You come back.
I'm imagining at this, but as a kid, you would have been providing your mum a fairly high level of care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those that you get this parallel sort of overdevelopment, and then that other part of your identity is completely underdeveloped.
Have you come into sync at all?
I think so. I think, you know, having gone away a couple of times and come back, it's mainly Dad has eventually come to terms with the fact that I'm a grown up person.
Yeah.
He still doesn't like to hear me swear, though, so.
Oh.
He says people don't yet like to see young ladies swear. I say, by people you mean you, by young ladies you mean me. I think swearing is clever and funny.
A university study recently proved that people who swear are smarter.
There you go.
Yeah.
Is it just more extensive vocabulary or...?
It is a way of looking for I can't remember it now. Sorry, I've been up forever. But I like to fuck with people on the radio by bringing fairly mundane ideas, but that have been proven by university studies, peer-reviewed journal published studies, and that was one of them. That was one of them. That,
swearing you know, is
swearing
clever.
Makes you smarter.
I like that.
I'll have to find it. I'll send it to you.
I think swearing is great. It's fantastic. It gives you a whole nother level of emphasis.
Yeah.
The C word particularly.
Which one?
The C word.
Oh, it's glorious.
I love it. I don't know if I can say it on your podcast.
No, I said it all the time.
I'm actually coming up against this because my dad wants to see the show on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And I've got a song where I say... It's about, you know, don't trust your gut, don't trust your heart, don't trust your cunt, don't trust the government, don't trust feminism. But I don't know what I'm going to do. Because I make jokes when I do a little bit of a disclaimer before. I say, hey, who's okay with the word and who isn't? And, you know, I'll tell you when to block your ears and that. And, of course, the night my dad comes, I won't sing that word. I'll make a different word, but it will be less funny because that's a fact. It's just a better word. All the other words for vagina are weak and flaccid.
I implore you to have that conversation with your dad from the stage.
Right, sure.
I implore you to say, Dad, I love you. And this thing that I do, that is what I love. I stand on stage and I make people laugh and people pay me money to come and do this, Dad. I make them laugh because I say this word.
Yeah.
And they're all cool with it. And everybody, my father's never heard me say this word. And you're about to hear me say it to him for the first time. It'll be the greatest freaking moment you could possibly give that audience. It'll be amazing.
I've had other nights. My dad is supportive. He comes and sees my comedy. But he just doesn't like the swearing. And I still do it. I'll cut a few ones out. It's good because I know which ones are necessary and which ones aren't.
Yeah. I do love a good... And thankfully, Audrey pulled me up about it. Audrey was like, she's like, a lot of your swearing is very, you know, it's, you know, bitches and motherfucker and cunt and very women-based. Like, yeah, you're right. Sorry. I have to figure that out. I have to sort that out. So I'm working with cousin fucker lately. It's a pretty good one.
That's a good one.
Because it's like,
I mean, you go to like other languages have some really good,
don't
like
they?
Arabic swears. Amazing.
The
combination
curses.
Of family, sex and... And
animals.
Blasphemy and animals. My dick on your god is one of them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, like, how do
my
you...
My dick on
your
god.
Or the sound of the wind through the flaps of your sister's cunt is another one.
The sound of the wind. I bet if anyone speaks Arabic, please, I want to know how to say that.
They're good. They're good visceral ones.
Yeah, I'm sure the consonants are just really chewy too. I think that's my favorite part about swear words is how chewy they are.
Well, my granny could swear in Hungarian.
Bless her.
For 2 minutes without repeating herself or stopping.
My grandmother's exactly the same thing. In Czech, sakramensky kluks like a splasny. And there was something else about that. There was something. Some really heavy religious ones.
The one that granny, she started, her like the start of it was always, bastem azulishten lofes a shegete. Which apparently has something to do with a horse's penis. I don't know.
And a kid.
Amazing, amazing.
So good. Yeah. Fuck, cunt, It's really not that. It doesn't hold a candle.
You want the old school, like, you know. Yeah.
The sound of the wind through the flaps of your seat.
Like, so good.
That is so good, man. Oh.
Well, it's like your brother is your uncle or something.
Oh.
Yeah. Or your brother's your father. So that kind of thing.
Your
all of the
brother's
ones,
your
the,
father
the ones
means
that are like.
He fucked your mum. Yeah. Ooh.
There's all sorts of complicated.
That is an Arabic one?
Yeah.
Damn.
There's sort of complicated family ones.
We've really got to pull Arabic our socks up. Good.
We do. Just like things.
Yeah. Maybe you should preface the song with this is nowhere near as good as some Arabic ones.
Yeah. I don't know what I'm actually going to do on the night. I'll have to play it by ear.
Who was the. So. You didn't want to do a law degree. You go to Cambridge.
I went to Cambridge, then came back and finished my law degree.
Okay, so you come back armed to the teeth with all of the law degree, every degree anyone could ever want as far as, okay, workplace, take me now.
Yes.
So what happened?
I finished my law degree, went to America for a year, worked at the Swiss bank UBS and hated it, then came back slightly depressed. And then started work at a big law firm here in Sydney and worked there for a year and a day. By that time, I'm doing stand-up at nights. I started stand-up properly when I was in New York. And just every paycheck that I ever got, I'd look at and think, what would I buy with this money? And the answer was always and invariably, I would buy that time back.
Wow.
You know, like...
You really are Buddhist.
But that's the thing. So now I have no money, but I think of it as money well spent. The money that I don't have is money I have spent on the time I have.
Mm.
Such a luxury. Time. I mean, we live in such a privileged society. I'm not going to starve to death. If I get sick, I'll be okay.
Yeah, but the TV is blaring at me to buy all these things because clearly I'm not happy if I don't have the new thing.
I wear the same thing every day.
Yeah.
Literally, I pick one thing and I'll wear it for about 3 months. I have two of these.
Do you launder it every night?
I have two of these, so I switch them over.
Yeah.
And then I'll pick something else. But I just don't have to think about it, which is good. I get more brain space. Efficient.
Is there a Buddhist vow of poverty vibe going on?
No. I think I just have I'm lucky. I have a good setup in my, not good even. I don't think it's a virtue. I think I'm lucky that I quite enjoy figuring things out. Oh, I have to fix that, or I have to repair that, or what's an easier way to get that, or that doesn't cost money. I enjoy that little puzzle world. It doesn't make me emotionally, I mean, you know, there's some people who when it's cold, it makes them angry and upset and fearful. There's something about that that makes them... In the same way, some people, they look at their bank balance, it's not what they want it to be. There's a real fear that comes out of them, like a visceral, like a panic reaction. I don't have enough money. What am I going to do? I don't have that in my head, whatever that button is. Mum didn't really have it. I didn't have that fear. So being poor can be annoying, but it doesn't bother me. And also, I pass. I'm lucky. When I was in Cambridge, I was there on a scholarship. I had about £2 a day to spend, but nobody knows that. The way that I speak, the way that I look, the way that I behave is all... It means I get a lot of the side benefits of being wealthy without actually having to have any of the money. I can move in certain society elements. I know how to dress or if I have to. So I don't get that thing that happens to people who are brought up in lower socioeconomic groups where they're constantly having to fight their way out of that box. I get the assumption that I'm wealthy, which does quite a lot. A lot of being wealthy is not actually having money. It's the assumption that you're wealthy and the things that you get as a result. I can go and take my laptop and work in a 5-star hotel lobby and no one will kick me out.
Do you?
Yes. On the reg, it's a very nice place to work. You know, nice toilets.
Yeah. You
know, often free Wi-Fi. It's fine. So.
Nice place to take a meeting.
Nice place to take a meeting.
I'm just downstairs at the Four Seasons. Come and meet me in the lobby.
Come meet me in the lobby. We'll go to the cafe there. It's easy.
You're not telling a lie.
No, there's no lies. I try not to lie. It's one of the precepts.
Yeah. What are they again?
I will refrain from wrong speech.
Yeah.
Lying, slander. Depends on how strictly you interpret it, maybe swearing. I will refrain from taking life. I will refrain from taking what is not given. I will refrain from intoxicants and drugs which cloud the mind. I will refrain from sexual misconduct.
Right.
That's the five precepts. Basic.
I think I'm pretty good there then. Yeah. I remember suspending the drinking one when I was at Chinrezig. Like, wow. I'll drink when I get back. Yeah, I should really get back into it.
Buddhism or drinking?
Yeah, No, I had to stop doing that 6 years ago.
Too good at it?
Not drinking?
Too good at it, drinking.
No, I was terrible at it. It made bad things happen that I could no longer control.
That's no good.
No, it was not good. Because I was not the person making the decisions. There was somebody else that lived inside me that would come out and make decisions that I then had to live with, and that was very difficult.
Yeah.
So I had to give it away. Let me rephrase it. I got to give it away. I was very lucky that I had the opportunity to give it away. There's many people that don't. Many people just keep going.
They don't get the chance.
No, they don't see. Well, some people don't have a problem. Was stopping. My problem was that I couldn't stop. If I started, I couldn't stop. And so I had to stop. Because exactly that, exactly. I would be overcome. It's just that full Jekyll Hyde thing. I would be overcome with this other that would say and do things that I would find, me sitting here in front of you, would find abhorrent.
Mm.
Abhorrent. But I would do them.
Yeah.
And say them. And then I would have to live with these choices. It was, yeah.
No,
life's better without it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll never say never, but I haven't, so I don't know. I think it's probably too late for me to start drinking. You know, yeah. I wouldn't have any of the coping mechanisms that people have.
So what does an alcohol-fueled social society look like from someone who's never drunk?
Pretty boring.
Yeah.
No, that's mean. It's not at all.
Because Cambridge seemed to run on beer.
Yes, it did. I don't know. I have. There's a couple of ways that you deflect that. Either you don't draw attention to it because it's not a massive, like, it's not a philosophical position that I hold. It's just what I do. So I don't think other people shouldn't drink. So I don't need to take a stand for it. And then also, there's a particular face that you can do when people are asking you why you're not drinking that implies that maybe you once did something incredibly regrettable that means they won't ask any further, or that you have, like, alcoholism in your family. You don't have to say anything. You just make this face when they offer. You're like, oh, I know, I can't. And they just don't ask again.
I think I do make that face.
Yeah, do you think you do it naturally?
I tend to make that face now, yeah. You put it on?
Oh, yeah, it just stops the conversation.
So great.
It stops the conversation and people don't feel obliged to convince you to join them.
Yeah, they do. They do. We are living in a world where more and more. Yesterday I saw that Comcast, the massive, gigantic American cable company, which owns Universal, which owns NBC, which just today bought DreamWorks Animation, Comcast this week announced they're doing away with set-top boxes, or your Foxtel box, essentially. The cable plugs straight into the back of your smart TV, comes down HTML5, so you don't even have to be on Comcast broadband to be a Comcast subscriber. So
Whoa. We
are living very rapidly into an age of independent digital broadcasting networks not being a thing anymore. You have your podcast. I have my podcast. What do you see for yourself in this new world of, instead of doing 24 nights at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival in a room of a few hundred people, which allows you to access maybe, I don't know, 5,000 people over the course of the month, being able to get that every 5 minutes
you know, 50,000 people a day via some sort of fantastic internet protocol show that you create.
I like that.
What do you see for yourself there?
All I've ever wanted to do is play with ideas. It's all I'm interested in. It's all I care about. And if I can figure out a way...
Two Hercules are flying past the house. Just thought I'd point that out.
Hercules the plane, not the mythic Greek figure.
Peter Garrett singing somewhere.
Yeah, I would like to do this.
To play with ideas.
Play with ideas. And if I can figure out a way to do it and also not starve to death, that's all.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, over the next sort of, I guess, 5 years, I have to start thinking about whether I want to have kids. And if I do want that, I need to be in a position where I have control over where I go. So I have to do scalable things. I can't tour with my shows, which is what I do now, which I love doing. But if I want to have a kid, then I need to at least have a base. And I don't necessarily need to make that decision right this second, but if I make that decision, I don't want it to be because I have to. I don't want to be able to go, oh, I can't afford to do that with my life. Like, I can't. I would like it to be a decision that's as unaffected as possible by my, you know, job. So that's my goal, is to try and figure out a way to get, you know, more people listening to Tea with Alice, do another podcast that's probably a little bit more accessible. Tea with Alice is just what happens when you give me a microphone and no brief at all. I was hoping it would be funny, but apparently it's just interesting.
It's okay. Is fine.
It's fine.
Sometimes I'm in the mood for an interesting podcast. Sometimes I'm in the mood for just, I just need something to giggle at.
The worst idea of all time? It's where Guy Montgomery and Tim Batt, who are two New Zealand comedians, watch... They have two seasons available at the moment. The first season is they watch Grown Ups 2 every week for a year and then do a review of it. And the second season is they watch Sex and the City 2 every week for a year. You don't watch them, you don't listen to the movie, you just listen to their commentary. 20 to 30 minute commentary afterwards. No, just their review of the movie of these. And it is like it's watching the Stanford Prison Experiments, but they're doing it to themselves, basically. It's, you know, this kind of complete losing of touch with reality with these two lovely, very funny boys. But if you want a dumb, fun podcast, it is that.
Wow.
It's completely meaningless.
There's a movie coming about a Stanford Prison Experiment, which I'm quite excited about. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's a really interesting cat, Stanley Milgram. Really interesting cat. The guy that did that.
Oh, yeah.
The Devil Gene, The Devil's... Devil Within Us. Can't remember the latest book he wrote. It's really interesting. I'm going to turn off the machine.
Okay.
And say thank you, because this has been so lovely to speak with you.
Oh, thank
Thanks
you.
Thanks for coming over.
Thanks for having me. It's been really good.
Oh, it's lovely. It's a lovely day. You came in. You brought me tea. Thanks heaps.
Thanks.
I'm just going to take your photo, okay?
Oh, okay.
Don't worry. You look beautiful.
Thank you.
All right. It takes a very quick amount of time. All right, 125th of a second, to be honest.
Oh, magic of photography.
That was Alice Fraser. You can find her on Twitter, Alliterative, Alliterative. Let her know that you heard her on the show. If you like this show, you feel like you want to support it, the least you could do is tell a friend. The most you could do is support the show on the Patreon page, patreon.com/Osher. It allows me to do things like hire Andy Ma, who's been producing the show for me and is doing a sensational job. I'm sure you'll agree. I've got a split. I've got to get on a plane to Brisbane, despite the fact that there's somewhat of a hurricane closing in on Sydney right now. So we'll see how that works out. Until I talk to you next week, thank you so much for listening. Sleep well and dream of beautiful things.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.